Welcome to An Amber a Day, the podcast all about functional nutrition for PCOS. I'm Amber Fisher, a certified nutrition specialist and licensed dietitian nutritionist, and I have training in functional medicine. I also have PCOS, and on this podcast, we discuss PCOS in depth, the nutrition strategies for it, as well as the realities of living with it and making this lifestyle work. For further guidance and meal plan support, you can check out the show notes for links to my PCOS courses and programs. And if this podcast helps you, please do me a favor and leave me a review. Thank you so much for being here. Let's get into today's episode. Hello, welcome back to An Amber a Day, the Functional Nutrition Podcast. I'm your host, Amber Fisher, and I'm so excited you're here today. We're going to be talking about one of my favorite illustrative topics, the priority pyramid. So if you don't know what that is, priority pyramid is a concept that I came up with when I was early on in my nutrition practice, and I was trying to explain to people why their hormone symptoms were not really about their hormones and why they should care about things like their adrenal health or their gut health or their blood sugar balance instead of just, you know, trying to figure out like what food can I eat to get better progesterone levels or whatever it may be. So it works really, really well, especially in cases related to PCOS, because so much of what drives our PCOS hormone imbalances are deeper physiological processes, you know, metabolic issues and things like that. So I'm going to kind of explain how that works today. And buckle up because it's going to be a fun ride. Well, actually, I don't know if you'll think that or not, but I think it's interesting. And actually, what the kind of cool thing about priority pyramid is, I sort of like came up with this concept on my own, but then as I've taken more training in the functional medicine world, I see different iterations of the same concept around in lots of different forms. So I think it's really cool because I think a lot of us who are meant to do this sort of systemic health and healing work where we're, you know, we're looking outside the box, we're looking deeper, we're investigating, we're getting to the core of issues and kind of rebuilding. We're just sort of born with this kind of mind that likes to do that kind of thing. And since that's fun for us, we spend more time doing it and then we end up, you know, helping people in that way. And we all kind of have this like same concept that's like almost built into who we are as people. I think that's really cool. I really do believe that like everybody is kind of meant for something. And I believe that if you really are excited about something or something seems like really wonderful to you, there's a good chance that like you would probably be really good at that. And there might be a place for you, whether that's like a career or a hobby or whatever. And I think a lot of people hold themselves back from even trying because they just assume, you know, like back in the day, okay, let me give you a little personal example. Back in the day when I was really interested in nutrition, I was researching it all the time, reading every book, like going on every blog, I thought, man, wouldn't it be cool to be like a nutrition podcaster and have a blog? Okay, keep in mind, guys, this was like 2012, 2013. So the world, the social media world was, landscape was very different. There was no like Instagram influencer types, like health influencer stuff going on. Like that kind of thing didn't exist, but there were blogs and there were starting to be podcasts. Like the age of the podcast had begun. And I followed this podcast. Shout out to the Paleo for Women podcast. I think it's called the Empowered Women podcast now. They've like, you know, rebranded along the way because they kind of, both of them got out of the whole paleo sphere anyway, but I was really into that at the time. So I'm listening to this podcast all the time, like obsessively listening to it. I'm just like, man, that is like the job, you know, like that would be the coolest thing to get to be working from home, getting to do podcasts, getting to research the stuff that you're like so interested in and talk about it all day and write about it. Cause I love to write, but I just thought, you know, that's like a one in a million thing to be able to be successful in some sort of online career and not have to go to like a
you know, 9-to-5 job or whatever, that's impossible. Like it's, you know, that's not going to happen for me. It doesn't happen for, but like maybe one or two, you know, people, it's, or maybe not one or two, but it doesn't happen very often. Right. And so I told myself there's really no point in trying because it's like, how would, you know, I mean, it's impossible. Right. And then like fast forward, and that's essentially my career. Like, I'll be honest that the grind of the whole like podcasting, making Instagram reels, like TikToks, writing blogs, writing newsletters, like seeing clients, all that kind of stuff is a lot more work than I it's a lot more of a job than I originally sort of figured. And making, you know, consistent money at it to where you can like support your family and stuff, just a moderate income, is a lot harder than it looks. Like, I remember thinking back when I first started my Instagram, I thought, man, if I ever have like, you know, 100,000 Instagram followers, like I'm going to have it made. Those people must have so much money. Like, they probably, you know, can just work when they want to. And it's, you know, they get to work being creative. And isn't that so amazing? And then now that I'm like there, I mean, I have, I think somewhere in the 80s, 80,000 or so followers, I realized like, oh, actually, no. Actually, no, there's not, you know, I mean, it's, I don't want to complain or anything, because I know I'm very lucky, and I do make, you know, I can support my family, most months, but, it's a lot more of a grind than it looks like from the outside, which I think is good. It's like not supposed to look like a grind from the outside, but anyway, it is still my dream job in a lot of ways. And I just, sometimes when I think back on that, I feel really grateful. And it also helps me appreciate like when I'm going through like a hard month, like, you know, the last year or so, the economy has been kind of weird and it has been more of a grind than it was previously. And so sometimes I can get a little down or start feeling, you know, like, maybe I'm not saying anything important anymore. Like maybe, you know, I've done everything I can do or what have you. And, when I start feeling like that, I like to think back on, you know, me back then thinking, wow, wouldn't it be cool to be like a blogger or a podcaster? And like, here I am, I'm doing it. So anyway, that is a very roundabout story in which to illustrate my point, which is that I really do think that if there's something that you are excited about, it might be meant for you. And certainly this kind of work was meant for me because I was just born with this sort of way of thinking about health that was a little countercultural, at least for the time. It's interesting to watch the evolution of our beliefs and our opinions about health and nutrition, even since hopefully you couldn't hear me burping there. I don't know what it is about like recording a podcast, but I get like a nervous throat. Do you guys know what I mean? Like, if you're going to have to give a speech or something and suddenly like you've been normal all day, but then suddenly your throat is like itchy, like you're getting like a scratch in it, and you're like, then you start clearing it. And then anyway, it's like an anxiety throat response. I don't know, but it's very annoying. I'll tell you that much. So apologies, especially with this new microphone. I'm sure you can hear like every smacking sound my mouth makes, which is, for those of you who don't like those kinds of sounds, is not going to be very fun. Anyway, it's been so interesting to watch the change in opinions about health and nutrition, even since I started working in this field, because back when I was like early on in my excitement about nutrition days, the concept of functional health, nutrition, holistic health, like combining conventional and alternative methods, like Eastern and Western medicine, all that kind of stuff was really kind of scoffed at. Like, there are some things that now are just a given. Like, for example, testing for vitamin D deficiency. Back when I started in nutrition, I had the hardest time getting doctors to run a vitamin D test. And because they were like, oh, that's, you know, that's just one of those woo-woo things. Like, that's one of those alternative things. Well, now it's like they do it automatically. It's like almost part of regular blood work for a lot of doctors because enough, especially since COVID and the connection between COVID symptom severity and vitamin D deficiency, like now it's like a standard thing, right? Same thing with like something like fish oil. You know, fish oil used to be really scoffed at, but then there were, you know, several studies that came out that showed, you know, benefits for heart health and things like that from fish oil. So now I have a lot of my clients be like, oh, I'm on a fish oil because my doctor said to, because for, you know, to help with my cholesterol or whatever. So it's like some of these things just become standard. They become part of our vernacular, and they used to be seen as like super cuckoo bananas. Oh, another example, intestinal permeability or leaky gut. Even when I started in practice, a lot of people still were like, leaky gut, that's fake. Like, that's fake news. Like, that's not a real thing. And then, you know, now we have so much evidence on the gut-immune connection, the gut-brain connection. I'm looking at a book right now called The Gut-Immune Connection on my shelf over there. We have so much research on that, and that's really where a lot of the umph for current research is going. And, you know, it's well established now that this is a real thing. So it's just funny. You know, I just think like, and that's not to say that I've never been wrong, because I certainly have. I have made some recommendations that I'm like, ooh, I cringe thinking about. In fact, I'm going through the archives of my TikTok right now because I'm looking for old videos that I've never reposted, to kind of do like an from the archives series, give myself a break from some from content creation. And some of them I'm having to skip over because I'm like, yeah, no, I don't know if that I believe that 100%, or I'd have to put caveats on it now that I didn't back then. So that's not to say that I'm like that myself or people in functional medicine are not wrong sometimes or don't exaggerate things sometimes or whatever. It certainly happens. But I do think there's like this kind of newer generation of health professionals that think differently about stuff, that think a little bit more expansively about certain topics. And that's good. That's a good thing, because progress is a good thing. Sometimes with progress comes a little bit of fumbling around. I'm not going to wait. Who did I hear talk about this recently? Somebody said recently, they're like, I'm not going to wait for research to catch up to what I know to be true. And that definitely, that mindset can get dangerous. Like, I could definitely see a way where that would not go in a positive direction. But for people on the cutting edge, there is some truth to that. It takes like 25 years of buildup of research studies for things to get like really solidified in the conventional world. So it's kind of nice to be over here on the edge where you can try some stuff out and see how it works in real people. And use your intuition a little bit more and stuff like that. Obviously, always by being safe, consult your doctor before anything, before taking anything on this podcast to heart. So anyway, disclaimer, we're going to get into the topic today, I promise. But as I said, I may or may not have said this in the last podcast, or I might have edited it out, but I'm freeing myself up a little bit with the structure of these podcasts for this year. For the last couple of years, I've been so like, let me follow this set list of things I'm going to talk about. It's going to be very educational, not a lot about me, not a lot about my opinions. It's going to be facts and evidence and whatever. And, you know, that served me for a time, but I'm kind of a little bit sick of that. I want to just talk a little bit more about different stuff and, go where my mind takes me. So we will get into today's topic, but
hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we are the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
That is a little bit about, that's a little bit of information on my opinions about career choices and hobby choices, etc. Speaking of that, this last weekend, I had my dance team performance. I'm not sure if I've mentioned it yet on the podcast, but I have mentioned that I have been taking salsa lessons for the last 8 or 9 months. And a couple months into that, I decided to join a salsa dance team at my dance school. And this is like, they have levels of dance teams or performance teams. So they have the freshman level, the sophomore level, the JV varsity level, and then the all-stars level. And I joined the freshman team, obviously, because I'm very new at this. But we have been practicing, like hardcore practicing, for months now. And we had our big performance on Saturday night. I might insert a video of this in the YouTube version if you guys want to see. Definitely, it's not perfect. And any of you who are salsa dancers that are more advanced are going to see all the mistakes. But I'm so proud of myself and of all the people on my team who have become good friends over these months. You know, it reminds me so much of summer camp, or when I was growing up, I was really involved in a church youth group, like super involved. Like I was there like 4 days a week. And it reminds me so much of that. Those were some of the best times in my life. And so it's so exciting to be part of a group like this again. Anyway, we had our big performance. There was this whole crew. It was like a weekender event where there were all these special lessons being taught by this dance group from New York City, Empire Mambo. So these are some of the most famous, you know, dancers of the style of dancing that I do, which is called Onto Salsa. Anyway, these are some of the most famous dancers in the world, apparently. I don't know anything about this stuff. This is what I hear from people in the know. Anyway, they were here. They taught workshops, which were incredibly hard, really fun. But, you know, nothing will make you feel more like a beginner than going to, like, some of these workshops. I'm like, okay, I can hang a little bit with, like, I can hang for a while. But at some point, I'm just like, okay, I'm so tired. Anyway, so they did this weekender event. And then there was a social dance in the evening. And we performed during that social dance. My mom and dad came to watch. But, you know, I am so proud of myself that I did that. And it was such a fulfilling experience because dance is something that I have always wanted to do. It's one of those things that I always felt like would be so fun, but wasn't for me. And a lot of it stemmed from body confidence issues and just feeling like I was bigger than other people. And so because I was bigger than other people, I wasn't like, I wouldn't be welcome in a space where like it's traditionally very feminine, or like the dancers are very, you know, petite, or they are very pretty or whatever. I just didn't feel like I fit in that kind of environment, or that I would be welcome there, you know. And when I was younger, I really wanted to join the dance team at my high school, but you had to go through pep squad first. And in order to, you know, do all that, you had to try out. And so I was just too scared to even try out for pep squad because I thought, you know, I am too big for this. They're not going to want a big girl on their pep squad. And looking back, like, That is so sad. It really is, because I really held myself back from doing that. And I do think I would have really enjoyed it. I would have gotten a lot out of it. And I'm sorry that I never did that, but those body confidence issues were real. Some of it was from the times. I mean, these were the early aughts. Like, I think I would have had to try out for Pep Squad in like 2002, 2003, something like that. And at that time, for those of you who were teens at that time, you remember, you know, anybody that was bigger than a size, gosh, who even knows, a size 4, like that was considered like fat, you know, in like the public sphere. And there was this element of like, if you were considered fat, then you were not welcome in public spaces. You certainly weren't welcome to like show your body off in some sort of sensual performance environment like dance. Like, you know, I mean, some teams might have had girls that were a little bit bigger, but it was almost like this like sort of embarrassment thing, like, oh, there's the girl on the team. So I was very aware of those standards at the time, and I didn't want to rock the boat. I didn't want to be like the token, you know, bigger girl. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, honestly, I wasn't even that big, and it shouldn't have mattered anyway, even if I was. Like, wherever I fell, like, I should have been able to feel comfortable doing that just because I wanted to do it and because, you know, it seemed fun and I could have been good at it. You know what I mean? So the whole thing is sad, but there's a redemption arc, because as I grew up, I got more comfortable with myself, and especially as I kind of made peace with my PCOS and my insulin resistance, and to some extent my weight, although I still struggle in that department, like I think many of us do. You know, as I made more peace with that stuff and more peace with my body, I realized like this was something that I could have done. I could have enjoyed and been good at. And then the thing that I let hold me back for a while was my age, because I thought, oh, I'm too old to do all that, which it's so funny looking back. Like, I remember when I went back to school to get my nutrition degree, I thought I was too old then. I was like 25. And I thought, oh, I'm too old to like switch paths. It's so silly looking back on it. You know, now that I'm 35 now, and I realize like at any point, like I could go back to school tomorrow, totally switch careers and have a very fulfilling like career in a different field, probably in multiple different fields if I wanted to. I don't want to go back to school because I'm sick of school, but you know what I mean? Like, time is on my side. I'm still very young. And you know, you can always change. You can always change direction. So I let my age hold me back for a while. And then finally this last year, when I was, you know, going to be turning 35, I would say probably since I turned 30, I've been on this kind of kick where I'm like, okay, things that I wanted to do when I was younger, things that were scary for me, things that I have fears around, I'm going to push myself to do them. I don't know why I'm like that. I just am. If I'm afraid of something, I'm like, well, I better do it. I better do it so I'm not afraid of it anymore. I like challenging myself like that. Like is the wrong word. I feel a need to do it anyway. So that's why I started doing the pole dancing for a while. I did that for a few years. I really loved that, and sometimes I really miss it. But once I got involved in dance, I just didn't have time or space. Like, my muscles could not handle anything else. And I'm really focused on this now. So anyway, I turned 35. I'm like, okay, this is it. This is the year I'm going to learn to dance. I'm going to do it. And I'm going to have fun. And I didn't even know that dance performance teams were like a thing, but they are kind of a big deal. Like, every dance school has performance teams, and, you know, a lot of adults of all ages are on these performance teams, and it's really fun. And so I joined, and anyway, the rest is history. Big performance on Saturday night went really well. So yeah, I don't know. I'm in a very good mood today, just coasting off the high from that experience still. But yeah, let's see. How long have I been talking? Probably a while. So let's get into today's topic, the priority pyramid. So to start off with, we tend to think about health in a certain way. And I alluded to this earlier, but we do tend to think about health as like a collection of separate experiences or separate systems. So, for example, we think the hormones are just about the hormones, or we think that heart health is just about heart health. Like, I had a lot of people, you know, come into my practice and say, like, oh, well, cardiovascular disease runs in my family, or type 2 diabetes runs in my family. And what people don't tend to realize is that just because something genetically runs in your family doesn't mean that you're fated to experience that thing. It does mean you're genetically more predisposed, but your environment and your lifestyle play the biggest role in determining how your genetics actually express. And, you know, some of that is out of your control, because if you were raised for, you know, however many years in the type of home that is contributing towards the development of insulin resistance, and you're raised on that diet and stuff, yeah, I mean, you're like, the odds are stacked against you early on, but there is so much that can be done to sort of reverse those things. And genetics are not set in stone. They can express differently based on how well you take care of yourself. So when we think about things like hormones, you know, you're born with PCOS, right? You have this genetic predisposition towards PCOS, but it's not just that you're born with extra testosterone, or that you're born with cystic ovaries or something. It develops with time because of a combination of factors that are not really hormonal at all. It's not like you just wake up one day, you know, you go through puberty, you wake up one day and you just have like high testosterone just because you're unlucky, or because you're you know, what have you. There's a combination of deeper factors, systemic issues that are happening that are building up into this experience where your body is making more testosterone. And then it is the testosterone, or, you know, high DHEA or whatever, that are driving the cystic ovaries. And then from there, a lot of that stuff is a cascade effect, right? So once we have cystic ovaries, we end up making too much estrogen because we're not ovulating and those little cysts are producing estrogen. Because we're not ovulating, we're not making progesterone. So, you know, that contributes to the whole cycle of us not ovulating again. And anyway, et cetera, et cetera. We know, if you've listened to a few podcasts, you probably know the mechanics of how PCOS works. But a lot of the symptoms that we have are seem hormonal, right? Like, so we'll have facial hair. And so we think, okay, facial hair, that's something that men have. That's a testosterone thing, right? Hair loss, that's something that men deal with. That's probably a testosterone thing. And, you know, to a lesser extent, things like weight gain and stuff. Testosterone can cause people to hold weight in the middle. So, yes, that is what's going on, but also why? The question to always ask is why? Why is this happening? Why are my hormones out of balance in the first place? Because, as I said before, it doesn't just happen out of nowhere. So, to kind of illustrate this point to people, I explain this concept of the priority pyramid. And if you imagine a pyramid, think about it as like a levels of priority thing. It doesn't necessarily have to be a pyramid structure. It could be a different thing, but you know, could be ladder rungs or whatever. But there's a top and a bottom to this. There's a accessory and a foundation. So on this pyramid, we have three main levels, and the top level is going to be our sex hormones. So this is going to be things like estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, all that kind of stuff. The kind of thing that we usually point to when we see PCOS symptoms and we say like, okay, these are out of balance and that's why I have so many symptoms. But beneath that, there are two other rungs that actually are the reason why these hormones on the top are out of whack in the first place. So in this, the middle, I tend to look at things like blood sugar balance. I tend to look at things like adrenal dysfunction, so the HPA axis. Even the thyroid can function here as well. These are things that are not necessarily root cause issues, but they are driving symptoms. So they are both drivers of symptoms and also driven by other things. They're in the middle. They're kind of like they're the middleman. They are part of what directs the sex hormones to be out of balance, but they're also things that get out of balance themselves because of the deeper stuff. And insulin could be argued, depending on who you talk to, that it might actually be like down on this bottom rung that I'm about to talk about. I usually put it in the middle though, because I find that like a lot of insulin resistance, there's a genetic component to it for sure, but that genetic component really can vary based on like a lot of the factors deeper in the body. So what's the deepest rung? The deepest rung is going to be our mitochondrial health, the health of our cells, our cell energy makers, and the health of our gut. The bacteria in our gut and the mitochondria themselves, which are kind of like the energy makers of our cells. Both of these things actually are connected to the way that our genetics express. So a lot of times we think about the gut as just being about our digestion or, you know, maybe just playing a role in like how inflamed we are or something. But gut health is actually really critical to the way that our genetics express as well. And so we have some research studies that show that if your gut health is out of balance, for example, you might be more insulin resistant, or it might drive adrenal dysfunction or something like that, because it creates sort of an inflammatory environment. The mitochondria, if you go back and listen to a couple episodes ago, I did an interview with one of my friends, Dr. Kalia Waddles, who is a functional medicine physician. She is incredibly brilliant, really passionate and excited, and she loves to talk about the mitochondria. So we did an episode on the mitochondria and PCOS. So I highly, highly recommend listening to it. I know it sounds a little bit like boring, but I promise you it's not a boring interview. It's actually really cool. So, but the mitochondria are in charge of a lot of that inflammation that gets produced as well, in genetic transcription, so like in how our genes reproduce. And yeah, there's just – and then also just like the energy that each organ that we have has to function to do its job correctly. So if our mitochondria are like really damaged, or they're really sluggish, or there's just not enough cleanup work happening for those, then that feeds into every area of our body, including potentially our gut health. Some might argue, I asked Kalia this, I'm like, what would you say is really like the true root of everything? You know, at least as far as we know in this current time, is it the mitochondria or is it the gut? Because a lot of people talk about the gut, and I certainly do a lot. I mean, I'm sure there's podcasts on here where I'm like, the gut is the foundation of everything. But, you know, there's something to be said on both ends. Like, and actually, I think after I've kind of given it some thought, and I think she said the same thing, that probably it's actually mitochondrial health that really is the true root of everything. Because I mean, that's where the energy comes from for everything. So anyway, that's the pyramid structure. So why is it in a pyramid? You know, what's the purpose of the pyramid format here? Well, the idea is to show you also that along with kind of each rung sort of causing issues in the rung on top of it, there's also this concept of like the body has certain things that it cares more about than others. So if our gut health and our mitochondrial health are not in balance, then the body can't like keep track of and manage and do a great job with the things on the middle rung. So like our thyroid health might suffer here. Our adrenal health might suffer here. Our blood sugar balance might suffer here, because, you know, this kind of inflammatory environment that gets created by issues on the deepest rung is not really conducive to great blood sugar balance or to great adrenal health. And so if those things, by extension, are out of balance, then it's really hard for the body to keep the hormones in balance. I mean, just anyone who's had a thyroid issue can tell you that your thyroid's out of whack. It obviously is going to mess up your hormones. I mean, this is one reason why a lot of women with thyroid issues, they get on thyroid medication and suddenly their fertility returns and they're able to actually get pregnant and maintain a pregnancy. They're actually able to, you know, lose weight again or do this or that. So there's a lot that is driven by that middle rung that then impacts that top rung with the sex hormones. And in PCOS, you know, good example here would be blood sugar balance and adrenal dysfunction, right? Both of these things can create more testosterone in the body. The insulin does this by directly driving testosterone production in the ovary. When insulin is a hormone, so when it's high, it sends signals to the ovaries to make more testosterone. And then the adrenals can do this in more subtle ways, but they can raise an androgen called DHEA, which then can sort of create that cascade effect of cystic ovaries and those other, you know, DHEA is an androgen, so it functions in much the same way as testosterone. And the adrenals can also throw off blood sugar balance even more, creating a more insulin-resistant environment, which raises testosterone. So there are different methods there. I've also seen too that like the adrenals being out of balance can of course contribute to ovaries or to egg health that's poorer, or to premature ovarian insufficiency, that kind of stuff. So it all plays a role and it can drive issues at the top. And there might be something to be said, for example, with something like estrogen kind of creating issues down at the base of the pyramid with gut health or with mitochondrial health. Like, for example, a very estrogenic environment can contribute to high histamine production, or it can also create imbalanced gut bacteria. But it's like a chicken or an egg, the egg situation. And in this case, I don't see a very many pathways for the estrogen to actually be like the starter thing that then drives the gut health mitochondrial issue. I see it the other way around. Now, I could be proven wrong on that, and I'm willing to be proven wrong. Maybe it's a circle, you know, maybe it's not a pyramid. Maybe it's like one of those little circular flow charts. I could see maybe a potential for like high levels of like plastic kind of exposures or endocrine disruptors, and then like liver health issues, like detoxification issues kind of playing a role there. But again, then that kind of connects back to the gut because the gut is a big part of detoxification. Anyway, I'm going off on a little rabbit trail here where I'm working things out in my own mind. But for the purposes of today's podcast, we'll call it a pyramid. And for this pyramid, we have to understand that in order for us to really fix what's wrong at the top, we have to fix what's wrong at the bottom. It's just not going to work the other way around. I can't put you on, here's an example, Vitex. Vitex is an herb that can help you create a little bit more estrogen at the beginning of your cycle and then contribute to you ovulating earlier, which then can help you make more progesterone and can kind of be supportive of more regular cycles. It tends to work fairly well in PCOS. I use it a lot with my clients. I like Vitex a lot. But if I don't have balance going on, or at least improvement going on the two bottom rungs of the pyramid, and I try to put you on Vitex, it's not going to do anything. You know, a similar concept here would be like birth control, right? Like, yeah, we could put you on birth control and kind of artificially alter the hormones, and your symptoms might reduce while you're on it. But go off your birth control and what happens, right? Any of you who have done this know it all comes rushing back. And this is something that like really bothered me a lot in the early days of managing my PCOS, because I really wanted there to be something prescription that I could take that would help. And I really did believe, because I feel like I was led to believe this, but maybe I misinterpreted, but I felt like a lot of my healthcare professionals were like, okay, take birth control and it'll fix the issue. It'll like fix your hormones. And, you know, I vaguely remember one of my doctors being like, yeah, and then if you get off of it later, your hormones will probably like be balanced again. Like they'll probably just adjust because of the birth control. That's not how it works at all. It certainly didn't work that way for me. And I think because of that, I placed so much focus for so long on the hormones themselves that I really neglected those deeper issues. And so every time I would get off birth control, I would create more issues for myself, because that kind of going on and off of birth control is really hard on the hormones of somebody who, like me, has, you know, some sluggish liver issues. I have the MTHFR gene mutation. Like there's some stuff going on that makes detoxification more difficult for me, not to mention like a lifelong struggle with like irritable bowel, which thank God is like actually has been under control for quite a while now. But you know, it wasn't certainly at that point. And so to go on and off of birth control like that was essentially to put a lot of pressure on my detoxification systems. And, you know, that contributed to more and more estrogen dominance, et cetera, et cetera. Eventually, I developed endometrial cancer from this kind of high estrogen environment. I find it funny too that the treatment for the endometrial cancer was like high dose progesterone, you know, because that sort of balanced everything out. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. What I'm saying is if you hyperfocus on your testosterone levels or your DHEA levels or whatever and miss the bigger picture, the deeper stuff, then we can do that dance all day. It's not going to end in you having a more balanced hormone profile. And I think that's probably why, like, there really isn't anything besides hormonal birth control. There's really no, like, no doctors are prescribing, I don't know, like, well, I guess they are kind of prescribing testosterone blockers now that I say that, like, spironolactone, right? But these things just kind of vaguely work. They don't really take care of the root. And the point being that there's really no good solutions for the hormone issues that last, right? And so that's where I think it is really one of the big proofs or indicators that PCOS is so much more than just hormone imbalances. Because if it were just hormone imbalances, you know, they'd put us all on like, we'd all be on spironolactone, hormonal birth control, and maybe progesterone on that combo for life, and all would be well, right? We would be like perfectly fine. But no, we still have these sort of long-term consequences, and we have these issues where we get off of this stuff and it all comes raging back. But what I think is the most concerning is the fact that like PCOS stays with you. Even post-menopause, you still have PCOS. You may not even have ovaries anymore. I don't have ovaries anymore. I had a total hysterectomy in 2020, but I still have PCOS because PCOS is really it's not named well. I mean, you don't even need polycystic ovaries to be diagnosed with PCOS. You can actually be diagnosed with it without polycystic ovaries. Look up the Rotterdam criteria for diagnosis. You only need two of the three. One of those three things is polycystic ovaries. But if you have the other two, you can have PCOS and not have PCO, not have polycystic ovaries, which is, you know, the disorder is misnamed, or it's what is the word I'm looking for here? There's a better – misnamed is not the right word. Those of you who are into vocabulary, let me know what word I'm looking for here. But it's named incorrectly or inappropriately. And I think I've heard talk about this, but I do think that like eventually they are going to change the name of it. But all that to say, it follows you through life, and untreated can result in higher risks of a lot of different stuff. We talked last week about the higher risks of depression, anxiety. Even ADHD is more common in PCOS. Bipolar disorder is more common in PCOS. So there's mental health things. There's also cardiovascular disease, diabetes risk, infertility. Like there's just a lot of things that are risk factors beyond just, oh, I have high testosterone, so I have irregular periods and I grow facial hair, so I just need to go get laser. You know what I mean? And the mistake that I think conventional medicine makes is just looking at those hormones and being like, okay, what can I do to manipulate these? And then, you know, there's some movement to manipulate the deeper issues, right? So metformin, of course, is going to manage insulin a bit better. And that's a very common recommendation. On the supplement side, inositols work just as well as metformin, sometimes better. And those are typically recommended. Fish oils have some good research for PCOS. N-acetylcysteine is my favorite supplement for PCOS. I mean, these things all work kind of on deeper issues and are a little bit more well known. But they're all just either Band-Aid approaches, or they're helpful, but they're not going to really fix those deep, deep mitochondrial and gut health issues unless there's a fundamental change to the way we're nourishing ourselves. Gut health can get out of balance for a lot of different reasons. Medications can contribute to that. Even things like sedentary lifestyle and trauma can contribute to that. But the biggest contributor is going to be our diet, because the diet is what directly feeds the beneficial bacteria. So if we're not feeding those, then over time, we're creating an environment in there that is pro more negative bacteria, or that's just pro the proliferation of specific kinds of bacteria at the expense of others. And it's really about the balance between those. And that balance is created by fiber, you know. Same thing with our detoxification systems, the gut being one of the major sites of detoxification for hormones. If we're not taking care of our mitochondrial health and we're not taking care of our gut health, then our body's going to really struggle with detoxification and elimination. This is why sometimes, like, if your cholesterol is high, like eating more fiber can help. It can also help with your estrogen dominance issues. So it's fundamentally about nourishment of those two areas. When we're not taking care of our mitochondria, which is also something that is done primarily through the ways that we nourish ourselves, then we get this increase in inflammation that's being created and an inability to clean that inflammation up, because we're not feeding ourselves with things like antioxidants, which are going to clean up oxidants. And we get reduced ATP production. ATP is like, you know, we talk about glucose being the food for the cells. Well, glucose eventually breaks down into ATP. And ATP is like the real food for everything. It gets a little bit technical there. This is where the Krebs cycle comes in. But just think about that from like, just if you were to hear that, you know, your body runs on fuel. If you are not able to create the fuel that you need, what's going to happen? You can't maintain everything, right? So some stuff's going to fall by the wayside. Your body at its core wants to keep you alive. That's priority one, stay alive. Priority like 857 or whatever is reproduce. If your body feels that it is in a state where it can barely manage itself, where it can barely keep itself going, it's not going to have the energy or the resources to promote reproduction. And there's some argument too for like certain things like PCOS being sort of evolutionary alterations to help the body reproduce during times when there was struggle. Like some people think that PCOS, because it is sort of this like insulin environment, it's like it's all these hormonal structures to kind of get you to like hold on to fat. And so a lot of people think that this might come from genetics of people who lived through famines because like end of the day, like yes, number one priority is keep yourself alive, but it is also important to maintain like the race must continue, like people must continue to be born. It is very primal to want to pass on your genetics. So some people think these are adaptations for those kinds of environments, which means that when we're in an environment where we're not in a famine, then suddenly we have all this stuff at our fingertips and it all goes haywire, right? Because we have access to too much stuff. So there's a lot going on here. But at its core, we have to manage our mitochondrial health and our gut health in order to have actual results with our hormones. And so I think the point that I'm trying to make with this podcast, besides just explaining this concept to you so that you can, you know, think more critically about nutrition recommendations that you see on the internet, is that when you are managing your PCOS, don't just look at your hormones to determine if you're making progress. The thing about hormones is that they can take a very long time to respond to deeper changes. And the deeper changes take a lot longer to really take hold than you would expect. So when I'm working with clients, I'm not really expecting to see regulated periods, major hormone changes, major changes to facial hair production, things like that, until I've been working with a person for like at least 6 months, but usually longer. I mean, it depends a lot too on where the person's starting from. Sometimes I'll have people come in who are freshly diagnosed with PCOS and it developed later. So they're like, they developed it in their like mid-20s, but they always had regular periods as a teenager, let's say. And then maybe they gained some weight or like they've been struggling in that department and they went and got tested and then they get diagnosed with PCOS. Those people tend to have the easiest time, relatively, with getting back to regular cycles because their body has that memory of having regular balanced hormones before. So really what I do with them is I help balance their insulin levels out because usually it's the insulin that's sort of triggering this wonkiness with the testosterone, and then they're kind of off with their cycles. But irregular cycles can vary, right? So it can vary from anywhere from like upwards of 35 days to months and months and months and months and months. And so it's my people who are like, oh, I have a cycle like, you know, some months it's 35 days, some months it's 45 days, some months it's like, you know, it's always around a month to every couple of months, but it's very irregular in the sense that like they don't know exactly when it's coming. It's not really on a schedule and the ovulation date gets pushed around. That's usually the influence of insulin. And so if we can manage the blood sugar better, suddenly their body's like, okay, we know the rhythm and it's can go back to its rhythm again. And those tend to be the people who have resolution of their symptoms the fastest. But if you've been living with never having periods or having a period once every 10 months for your whole adult life, and now you're in your 30s and you're trying to get pregnant and it's not working, and you know, you're just coming from a place where a lot more has built up, a lot more damage has occurred, and it's going to take longer to regulate if and this is just being totally honest here, if we can regulate you fully at all. I don't say this to be defeating, but there is a collection of people, myself included, I believe. I don't know because a lot happened to me. Not to go into it, but a lot happened to me to where I really didn't have time to really test things. But I do think that there is a collection of people with the most severe PCOS symptoms who probably will never get like fully regular periods back. Their hormones will probably always be a little bit wonky, but that's not to say that they can't make major changes. I think they can make a lot of changes to how inflamed they are, to how insulin resistant they are, to how well they nourish themselves, to how well their cells are functioning, to how well their detoxification systems are functioning, and get in a much better place with their hormone balance. But there may not be time before they hit menopause for them to actually like fully fix it, get to the point where they're having like 30-day cycles. I just think I like to be realistic. And I think with the way that we live now, the way that our world works, the way that our food system works, there's a lot stacked against us that is outside of our control. Think about things like soil quality. How much zinc are we getting from our fruits and vegetables that we were getting like twice of or three times as much back when our grandparents were eating fruits and vegetables? So we have to do a lot more now to get the same benefit. The impact of endocrine disruptors is something that I think we're going to see more and more information on over the years. And that's something that's really in a lot of ways outside of our control. Plastics in our environment, you know? So, and that is something that disproportionately impacts those with PCOS. So there's a lot of things that build up that we can't do much about. And if you are coming from a place where you've had a lot of years built up with these things without really knowing about the need to work on your nutrition, because some of us are just, we're not educated on that, just didn't know, or we knew, but we didn't want to, you know, do anything about it at the time, then it may not be like the most feasible thing to get everything sorted out perfectly, like some people can. And a lot just really depends on where you're coming from with that severity. I mean, it's interesting because I've worked with a lot of people over the years. I've been in practice almost a decade now. And mostly with those with PCOS, like that's mostly what I've done. I've done some other stuff, like I'll do some stuff with autoimmunity. I do a lot. I have like kind of a little word of mouth thing going with like upper digestive stuff like nausea and GERD. I do a lot with that, food sensitivity, that kind of thing. But most of the work that I've done is with PCOS, and it's usually my clients who haven't dealt with PCOS symptoms as long that have a better chance of getting them fully resolved. That it is what it is. And I say that from a place of love because like I believe I'm one of those people as well. I mean, I ended up getting cancer at 25. So I don't think we were in – I don't think there were like great odds that I was going to get like perfect 30-day cycles. But I didn't even really get the chance to try, you know, knowing what I know now. I would love to see what would happen knowing what I know now if I also didn't have the fear of getting cancer again and I could like try out – stuff. I'd love to see what I could do, but I'm not going to get that choice anymore because, you know, at this point I'm postmenopause. So it is what it is. And for some of us, some of you, I know some of you listen to me, you are already postmenopause as well, or you're in your, you know, early 40s, or, you know, you're at a place where it's like, it's kind of, it is what it is situation. And now we're just doing cleanup work. We're doing what we can. Right? That's okay too. There's still a lot of value in that because like I said before, this is something that is going to affect you. PCOS stays with you throughout your whole life. So at that point, when we're not looking at, let's try to get totally regular periods, now the goal post changes and it's let's have a better quality of life as we age. Let's reduce our risk of long-term health complications. Let's keep our hearts healthy. Let's keep our bone density, you know, in a good space. So our goals change. But at the end of the day, to do any of that stuff, whether it's regulate periods or reduce our risk of chronic health issues as we age, it starts by taking care of the mitochondria and the gut. Now, how do we do that? There's a lot to that. I may have to make a part two to this podcast because I'm looking at the time and I've been recording now for like over an hour. Obviously, I'm going to edit it, so it's not going to be an hour long that you're listening, but still, I've been recording a long time and I think this is going to be a long one. So I'm not going to go too much into depth today on like what we can do. I might make a part two, but what I would suggest, and I'll try to link to some of these in the show notes, is go back and listen to my podcasts that are specific to gut health. Listen to that one with me and Kalia that talks about mitochondrial health. Listen to the one about gut health, and then I may do another one specifically about supporting your mitochondria. I actually already have something like that. I'll look. Anyway, you will see. You'll see in the next few episodes if I end up doing that or not. But big things, more fiber, that's for your gut. More antioxidants, that's for your mitochondria. Exercise for both. So antioxidants are going to be like your PCOS superfoods. I do have a podcast on the PCOS superfoods, so highly recommend listening to that. Your leafy greens, your veggies, your even things like dark chocolate, stuff that's high in magnesium, like peanut butter, all that kind of stuff. Mostly your veggies and your fruits, right? Like your berries, all that kind of stuff. The stuff you know is healthy for you. That's going to support your mitochondrial health. With mitochondrial health, we always say eat the rainbow. So eat lots of different colors of fruits and veggies. For gut health, we're talking fiber. So that means more, obviously vegetables are going to contribute to that, but also we're looking at things like legumes. So beans in your diet, having things like whole grains in your diet, being careful with grains, obviously, because too many grains or an imbalance between grains and protein and fats can create more of an insulin response, which could be negative here. So being careful with grains. However, whole grains are, and particularly legumes, are where we're going to get a lot of our fiber. But it doesn't have to be a lot. Like I would definitely look at how much fiber are you getting from these different things and plan accordingly. So we're looking to get at least 30 grams of fiber a day. But honestly, if I'm being totally honest, I think with PCOS, we'd probably benefit from more. But work your way up. If you're going to try it, work your way up. Because if you do too much fiber too fast, you'll make yourself constipated and miserable. You know, even things like psyllium husk, a little psyllium husk to bridge the gap can be helpful here, but it should mostly come from whole foods because then you're going to get those mitochondrial benefits as well. So you're kind of like killing two birds with one stone. Exercise for both. This is because exercise helps with mitochondrial repair. It also helps with bacterial balance in the gut. Really cool. There was a study done that showed that exercise on its own with no diet changes altered the gut bacteria balance. So exercise for both because it's going to help with not only with like repair for mitochondria, gut health balance, but it's also going to help with insulin, which is then going to help with the amount of cleanup work that has to be done. It's going to reduce that. So exercise is key for both. I do have planned to do an exercise and PCOS podcast very soon. It's on my, it's in my little notebook here and I wrote it down. So I have to do the planning for it and pull studies and things like that, but that is coming. So yeah, those are the big things. And I hope this was interesting for you. Hope it helps. Thanks for listening to, thanks for listening to my thoughts at the beginning about dance and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I appreciate you guys. But definitely reach out if you have questions. There's a form you can find in the link tree that's questions for the podcast. And I love to answer questions from you guys. And I'm planning to do more of that this year. And if you have not left a review, but you on iTunes, but you've reached this point in the podcast, I know that you are a solid listener. You are a person who is very close to my heart, because not many people make it to the end of these. So please, 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 please do me a favor. Leave me a review. I kind of need to, I don't know. Reviews, everybody's entitled to leave the review that they want, but I'm really trying to get more 5-star reviews, because lately I've gotten a couple of 1-stars, which has made me sad. So anyway, you know, I'm not for everyone, but if you are a listener and you've gotten anything out of this podcast, please do me a favor. The way it helps the most is if you rate it on iTunes. So it's kind of annoying because you have to like go find me on iTunes and then rate it from there. You can also rate me on Spotify, but I think it matters more if you rate me on iTunes from what I've read. Anyway, thank you guys. Talk to you soon. Bye.
If you learned something today or you enjoyed today's episode or both, I'd love it if you would leave me an iTunes review and share this with a friend. If this brought up a question for you that you would like to hear me answer, there is a Google form that you can use to ask me any question you want, and I might answer it here on the podcast. I do it all the time, and I would love to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time.